Well, good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at by calling 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we specifically ask that you hold your calls for the time being, because we have on the line with us from World Affairs Brief, the editor, Joel Skousen. Hi, Joel. How are you doing tonight?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan.
Well, is it rainy up there where you are?
No, we had a beautiful day.
Well, I guess we got all the rain down here.
Yes, the jet stream has been taking it north and south, but we've been having a nice reprieve up in Portland.
All right, fine. Well, let's tell me, what are we going to talk about tonight? What are the latest things on World Affairs Brief?
Well, I did a lot on the situation with Arafat. We finally have Arafat dead and gone. My headline was Arafat dead and gone to hell. And you won't read that headline, Dr. Stan, in any newspaper.
No, I'm sure you're not.
But and nonetheless, I think it's true.
And now, things have been so interesting. I don't know whether Arafat had AIDS or not. All we know is that he had some sort of disease and they couldn't diagnose it, which is pretty strange in this day and age. But what was so interesting is the fact that up on the Internet, there were so many articles going into his homosexual background and not a word of it in the controlled media press.
That's right, and that's the reason to this very day they keep saying he died of an unknown ailment. Now, you can't tell me in today's day and age that he had an unknown ailment. Had all the signs that point to AIDS, but this is a very tight, controlled secret that he's not only a homosexual, but a pedophile, and Barry Chamish came up with some very dramatic evidence this week on that, and I'll quote from that. This comes from the memoirs of Ion Pachepa, who was the bodyguard or in the ruling regime of Nicolae Ceaușescu of Romania, and he was the former intelligence chief, and they tape recorded, videotape Arafat's orgies with his bodyguards. Now, this very, very strong evidence that was within the old Soviet Empire that he really was a homosexual. And this is a very prohibitive thing in the Islamic world, of course, and so this had to be kept secret. And that's one of the reasons why, of course, he had this, mistress wife, Sua, who he, rarely lived with.
She lived in Paris and he lived in Palestine. What a wonderful relationship.
Yes. In any case, the news was very, very controlled about the state of his health. I'm glad that we don't have to cover that anymore. According to a leak from Paris military authorities, Arafat actually died on November 7th. But French officials in league with Palestinian leaders were demanding that the doctors keep him alive artificially while they continued their infighting over the issues of secession. And they had to deal, of course, with Arafat's wife, Sua, who had suddenly shown an interest in controlling Arafat's ill-gotten gains. Now, she has been on a stipend of several million dollars a year, keeping her in wealthy accommodations in Paris, jet-setting around the world, kissing up to people like Hillary Clinton, and showing their token child around to the world, basically doing a PR thing. And now she wants a piece of the action.
Well, it's such a tragedy that we have to have people like this in positions of power, but they are in positions of power all over the world today. I will be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joel Skousen. Go ahead, Joel.
Interesting how the French military doctors were covering up for his condition. I had a one of my good friends up here was saying, you know, listen carefully what they're saying. They really aren't lying to us. But everything they say can still be true, and Arafat can still be dead. The French were saying words like this, very carefully worded, his condition is stable, or his heart is still beating strong. Now, you can be dead and have a stable condition. That's what's more stable than death? His heart beating strong. They were actually keeping it going with electronic stimulation, but the brain was dead, the kidneys and liver were dead. That means the body, as you know, the doctor is becoming a toxic morass. You start circulating blood around without kidneys and liver working, and the body stinketh within a few hours. Anyway, obviously there was more to the French prohibition against visitors than we don't want anyone to disturb him. You know, in a deep coma when you're brain dead, I don't think anybody was going to disturb Arafat. But you know, the delays did pay off, Dr. Stan. His top henchmen, Abu Ala and Abu Mazen, these are both nom de guerre. All big shots in the terrorist world have these war names. They rushed to Paris not only to ascertain that Arafat really was dead, but to present Arafat's wife with a, quote, offer she couldn't refuse. You know, Sua Arafat, described by one pundit as an Arab whore on high heels, she's actually a Christian Arab with stylish Western taste who lives in a posh French apartment and jet sets around the world. With a reported stipend of over $2 million a year of Arafat's slush fund, she, of course, lives very well. And her interjection into the affairs of Arafat's death were meant actually to try to get a piece of Arafat's hidden fortune. That didn't set well with Arafat's other members of his den of thieves. Her only interest, of course, in controlling the circumstance of Arafat's hospitalization, which she actually, by the way, did not control, the French did, was at the behest of the PLL friends, was to assert her legal status as a wife so that under French law, her lawyers, through the French courts, could try and find and control Arafat's hidden bank accounts. Because Sua doesn't know where the money is. She just knows that one of his henchmen put money into her bank account each month. But ordinary Palestinians now are very outraged about the talk about Arafat's loot. While they starve, of course, they find out their vaunted leader had been stealing most of the aid money dished out by the U.S. Congress, $75 million a year, and the European Union. As if to maintain the front, Arafat's financial advisor, Mahmoud Rashid, yesterday had the audacity to claim that Arafat owns no property.
Oh, this is Dr. Stan. Joel Skousen is covering the fact that I'm aware of Arafat's wealth, and apparently you were saying one of his aides said what?
This was his financial advisor claiming on a public television interview that Arafat lives in poverty, owns no property, and has made a vow of poverty, has no money in the bank. Now, that takes real gall considering the billions the world's most famous terrorist has stashed away.
Right, they've done some CBS 60 Minute specials on that, and it was estimated several billion dollars that he had in Swiss bank accounts.
You know, no one really has expressed any outrage at this corruption. No one knows for sure where Arafat's stolen funds are. They're hidden, except the Israelis, of course, who helped him set up Swiss and other foreign bank accounts, which is a story in and of itself. I suspect that the Israelis, if they haven't already drained the accounts, will use it as a bargaining chip in future negotiations with the Palestinian Authority. What the PLO did have knowledge of and some control of are the whereabouts of several billion dollars that Arafat used to purchase villas, hotels, businesses, and other assets that gave he and his cronies a steady source of income. Now, you have to ask yourself, why did he need, a steady source of income if he had all this money squirreled away in secret Swiss bank accounts? Well, he didn't want to, in his condition, have to go into that account and make transfers, which would involve other people. He wanted to keep some secrets, so he didn't want to touch that for fear if he went into exile, then he'd have a nest egg. And so he used these other sources of incomes in the meantime. So the Palestinian Authority is going to get control of those other business assets that Arafat had. But I really do think that Arafat did die of AIDS. He had all of the basic blood disease that depresses his immune system, dropped in considerable weight, as much as a third of his body weight. He was suffering intermittent mental dysfunction, very much like the symptoms of AIDS. What's really hypocritical, however, is that in the supreme act of hypocrisy, leaders of nations have rushed to petition Israel and Egypt for permission to attend Arafat's memorial service in Cairo on Friday and his burial in Ramallah this weekend. Israel did prevail in its insistence not to allow Arafat to be buried in Jerusalem, which would have, of course, added to the Palestinian claims of another sacred site to worship. But some heads of state are attending. Most are trying to play a middle ground of sending lower-level people. I think, for example, when you are claiming to fight a war on terror, there isn't a single head of state that should be sending any representative to the funeral of the most famous terrorist in the world.
And I think people have forgotten he was behind that attack on the athletes in Munich many years ago, and actually assassinated an American ambassador, and all sorts of terrible things. You know, that was back in the late 60s, early 70s, but he was still the same terrorist he had always been.
That's right. You know, most notably, French President Jacques Chirac, who's supposed to be a conservative, is going to attend the funeral. Germany's Marxist foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, is going to attend the ceremony in Cairo. There'll be deputy foreign ministers from Britain, Russia, and Spain. Although Tony Blair says that I think he's might be going to the memorial service. Kofi Annan says he's not going to go. The only smart one, I guess. The United States is planning on sending either Colin Powell, who's on the outs with the administration, or Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter. Now, that's appropriate. The Israelis are playing it cool, though. They're not going to send anybody, which is very smart of them. Now, there is some news on the secession going on in the Palestinian Authority. It looks like Abu Mazen, whose real name is Mahmoud Abbas, is the former prime minister and peace negotiator. He was elected chairman of the PLO on Thursday, within hours after Yasser's death. According to news, this puts him on the fast track to be the overall leader of the Palestinians. He's 69 years old, known as Abu Mazen, as I said, as his nom de guerre. He's long worked in Arafat's shadow as the PLO's number two official. There are three titles, though, that Arafat held, and this is what there's going to be a real battle of secession over. One, he was president of the Palestinian Authority. Two, he was the leader of the Fatah movement. And third, head of the PLO. Now, the PLO vote was unanimous, giving Ibrahim Najaf, or a cabinet minister, who said that means no one will compete with Abu Mazen for the president, but don't be too sure of that. There's a radical radical movement for power behind their backs, and they reportedly have French backing. This radical movement, who doesn't believe in any accommodation with the international community, as PLO Politburo Chief Farouk Kudami, Arafat's chief confidant, Hani al-Assan, he's chairman or commander of the Force 17 bodyguards that protect Arafat. Palestinian speaker Rawi Fatou has been sworn in as temporary president of the Palestinian Authority pending election. Now, his selection is kind of telling. Everyone says he's a moderate, but he has impeccable terrorist credentials, having been part of the National Palestinian PLO Council in 1983, the Fatah Revolutionary Council in 1989. Now, you don't get to that position by being a moderate. One thing, however, he's relatively mild in his infighting skills, so he won't challenge the real contenders, and I think that's why he's been elected president pro tem. So we'll see, and I'll report on that in the World Affairs Brief in the future, how this turns out, but I don't think it's going to be a peaceful transition. Hamas is the big power there in Gaza, and I think they want to control the Gaza Strip in the future.
Okay, fine. And, of course, they still are getting a lot of funding out of Saudi Arabia, aren't they? Aren't they one of the large sources of income for Hamas?
They are.
Right. They are good friends, the Saudis, of course.
Oh, yes. Next subject is Ashcroft's resignation, what's behind it. First of all, some disinformation. An anonymous blogger from Southern Arizona is claiming on the Internet, quote, "We received information from very reliable sources indicating that one of the reasons John Ashcroft is resigning is Bush's irresponsible and dangerous position on illegal immigration. An indictment of Bush's immigration schemes was said to have been part of the 10-page handwritten letter of resignation submitted by Attorney General Ashcroft. Only 6 pages of that letter have been released." I'll tell you why this is not true. First of all, letters of resignation are typed and submitted when each cabinet member comes on board, giving the president an automatic option to get rid of anyone who doesn't work out. The ones that are produced recently are merely feed an appropriate excuse to the police. The press. And third, they're always done on a computer. They're always typed. They're never handwritten, especially 10 pages. So this thing just appears very, very bogus. Thirdly, John Ashcroft was a supreme Bush yes man. He would never contest policy. A person who defended all of the most egregious things, including the Patriot Act, and threw people in jail without cause, certainly isn't going to winch at Bush's immigration scheme. So I'm not buying that at all.
No, don't you think they intentionally plant these articles? I mean, some of them may be spontaneous, but some of them are really planted articles of disinformation just to confuse us?
Well, that's right. It plays, of course, into the Alberto Gonzalez pick as replacement attorney general. Here's the person. His parents were illegal aliens, so if anybody's going to be friendly to that cause, it makes it appear as if that's the reason Bush picked Alberto Gonzalez. First and foremost, though, of course, Alberto Gonzalez has been a totally predictable counselor and yes-man to Bush, as much so as John Ashcroft. He's got a nice guy image. Ashcroft had a nice guy image, but he certainly became one of the most hated people in the Bush administration, probably number one in most people's book, those that didn't hate Bush himself, just ahead of Tom Ridge. The people who are trying to enforce this terrorist requirements and homeland security requirements are very, very unpopular with the public. So these are the people that want out. They want to start getting a new life. These people have secure incomes promising them. They really, in their own minds, see all of the rest of the conspirators and this insider government organization earning millions of dollars, like Dick Cheney going to work for Halliburton. Here they are at a low six-figure salary working as a government bureaucrat and taking all this flack. That's why they really want out. I mean, if a line forms right at the front of the door, can I get out this term? Can you replace me? And a lot of them don't get permission to get out. But Ashcroft did his job. He took the heat. Now he wants to retire and slink away as the snake that he is. Alberto Gonzalez, of course, has impeccable credentials. He's the one who helped craft the Patriot Act for the Bush White House. He was White House counsel. He's not really a conservative, as pointed out by a vice presidential candidate of the Constitution by Chuck Baldwin. Chuck Baldwin, he was on the Texas Supreme Court in 1999. He's the one who ruled angry conservative by voting to allow a teenager to get an abortion without notifying her parents after a notification law was passed in the state of Texas. At the time, he criticized the position taken by his colleague on the court, who was not supposedly a conservative, Priscilla Owen, who voted against allowing the abortion because it was the law of Texas. Gonzalez said in his dissenting from the majority opinion, that her dissent would be an unconscionable act of judicial activism. Well, that's like the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, Gonzalez is the one that broke with the law and was guilty of judicial activism, not Priscilla Owen.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment. Our special guest this evening is Joel Skousen, and of course he's discussing the fact that anybody who thinks that Alberto Gonzalez is pro-life or pro-a constitution or certainly a conservative hasn't watched his career. We'll be back here in just a moment. And of course, when we return from this break, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen. Pick it up from there, Joel.
The ACLU is also against Gonzalez, so you have liberals and conservatives concerned. Now, the conservatives won't fight against him, of course. Most of the conservatives in Congress, especially the Senate, are actual moderate liberals and fronting as conservatives, never do fight that cause, and are very much inveterate yes men to the Bush administration. The ACLU will attack this because Gonzalez is known to have been behind the Patriot Act, and the executive director of ACLU, Anthony Romero, publicly called upon the Senate to give Gonzalez a thorough thrashing for his support of the Patriot Act. Romero said there are serious questions, quote, about Mr. Gonzalez uphold domestic and international obligations to protect civil liberties and human rights. Now, of course, Gonzalez will say exactly that, that I will uphold all those rights in the fight against terrorism, but he will continue to defend the Patriot Act. And even Bush has said he would veto any move by Congress to reform or modify or take away the Patriot Act. There are certain things that these people are very adamant about, and they won't take the will of the people's voice on them. One of those is illegal immigration, which Bush is still trying to mount a cause with. The Republican congressmen have just told the White House, we are not going there. There is not enough public support, and that's the quickest way to make them mad at us if we push something. So it doesn't look like Bush will be able to get it unless he comes in through the back door with something, because almost like gun control, Republicans pushing for giving another amnesty bill to illegal aliens is akin to getting unelected. They will make conservatives very mad. Okay, let's go now, I think, if you are willing, to the assault on Fallujah.
All right, I think that's a fascinating subject, and we should all be concerned about that.
It is my assessment that the assault on Fallujah, just like the destruction of Guernica and the Spanish Civil War by Nazi aircraft, is so destructive as to become a symbol of resistance for many years to come. This entire operation diverges strongly, Dr. Stan, from the U.S. pattern of playing it easy on the Iraqi resistance. In Najaf, for example, three times the U.S. went after the insurgents. They had control of the whole city, that is, the insurgents did. They always declared a ceasefire and withdrew just as they were about to surround and annihilate the enemy. In this case, they completely surrounded the city of Fallujah with some 15,000 troops and began an air and artillery campaign that will come close to leveling large portions of this city.
Well, what about all the civilians there, though?
Well, about two-thirds of the civilians have left, but there are about a third that are still there, and they are under the most dire circumstances. Now, this won't be a Dresden. I mean, this won't be an abject firebombing of the city, but it's going to have the same effect. This whole operation began well before PM Prime Minister Alawi supposedly gave the order for attack. I remember General Metz saying, we're waiting for the order to attack. Why, they'd been doing airstrikes on Fallujah for a whole week prior to that.
What happened to Alawi's family? Apparently they'd been kidnapped.
Well, they are still unaccounted for. Alawi is not making any statements about this. He's playing like he's not going to be concerned, that he's not going to be intimidated by terrorism, but they definitely are starting to retaliate. There have been some massive car bomb explosions. They're getting bigger and more powerful.
Now my understanding is that some of the leading Shia clerics are just saying, don't boycott the election in January as a reprisal.
That's
for
correct.
Them.
Correct. They're bailing out.
Hold
really
that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Joel is talking about the attack on Fallujah, and of course, large parts of the city are being leveled. About two-thirds of the civilians have left, a third are there, and they're under terrible straits. What this is doing is antagonizing the whole Islamic world, and specifically the people there in Iraq. And, of course, leading Shia clerics are saying, boycott the election in January. Do not vote in January. This is where we retaliate. And, of course, what that's going to do is create a situation where the Americans are going to say, oh, shucks, well, we're just going to have to stay here. After all, the election didn't represent the people, so We're just going to have to stay on, which will only create more animosity and more hatred. And, of course, Iraq is dying. We have, you know, when we got in there, we did away with the military. We did away with the police. We fired everybody who has been a member of the Ba'athist Party, and they're the ones that made the society run. This is why you don't have water most of the time. You don't have electricity most of the time. You don't have sanitation most of the time, because we fired all the people who knew how to do it. And then we wonder why there's chaos there. And then you try to reorganize the police force and reorganize an army after you've done away with a hierarchy that you could depend on. Most of them were not dedicated to Saddam. They were doing a job, and you had to join the party to be, you know, to work or to get ahead in the society. And of course, we've done everything we could to destabilize that tragic country. Have you seen that figure, 100,000 Iraqi casualties?
Numerous times. It's very hard to put a real figure on it, but I'm afraid that it's not that far from that.
What's so interesting is, of course, there's a lot of disinformation. Looks like government websites up there that say, oh, Iraqi civilian casualties are maybe between 10 and 16,000. And you've really got to type in on Google 100,000 casualties to get the reports out of Reuters and out of The Guardian, out of Europe. So obviously there's a conscious effort to lie to the American people about the extent of the civilian casualties.
And they're still understating the extent of American casualties as well. I mean, they're understating the deaths by at least half and the wounded by almost three times. They're saying there's only 178 wounded today, and you know, when I tally up the various individual reports I've seen, it comes well over to 300.
What do they say in war? The first casualty is truth.
Yes, but there have been, you know, this was billed by General Metz as an Iraqi operation. The U.S. was simply in support of it. Nothing could be further from the truth. There were a few hundred token Iraqi troops, most of them deserted, including their officers, rather than fight against their own people. This is definitely a U.S. operation. Most of the destruction that's going on is by aerial bombardment, and believe me, you know, you cannot avoid a great deal of civilian damage when you're using the kind of bombs and aircraft they're using. Over 9,000 shrapnel-giving bombs have been thrown in there, and what are they called? The cluster bombs, actually, were dropped. Eyewitnesses report that in many regards the U.S. bombing is more intense than what the U.S. threw at Baghdad during the beginning of the Iraqi war. So this is a really very bad. Mafkarat al-Azram, reporter, that's the name of the local daily newspaper, said the morale of the remaining civilians, about a third, is very depressed. He reports the medical situation is almost non-existent since the U.S. targeted the local hospitals in the opening days of the campaign. A hatred for the U.S. is growing in Iraq, they say. So what we see in Fallujah, frankly, is a massive annihilation attack. The intent of the U.S. forces is to completely surround and crush a major sector of the resistance. But strangely, the U.S. is already putting out the word that the important leaders of the insurgency might have escaped early on. Now, this is really disinformation. The city's been surrounded for weeks. No one can go in or out without going through U.S.-controlled checkpoints. So, you can't have it both ways. Either the leaders like Zarqawi or others do not exist, or they're still inside the besieged city. And frankly, I think that the leaders don't exist, or if they've escaped, they've been allowed to escape. Meanwhile, insurgents have started to make good on their threat of retaliation. We've talked about, you know, larger and larger car bomb attacks, taking a toll on both Americans and Iraqis thought to be collaborating with the Americans. And as you mentioned, three members of Prime Minister Alawi's family were kidnapped at gunpoint on Tuesday as they left their home in Baghdad. So this is this story is not open, even though, of course, the U.S. is going to win the Battle of Fallujah. They're not going to win the war over it.
I don't think they're going to win the hearts of the Iraqi people. A fascinating article in the New Yorker magazine, 15th of November issue. If you have a chance to get hold of it and read it, and it concludes with the thought on the part of one of the high-ranking Iraqis who then before, Iraq is dying today. Iraq is dying today. I mean, the whole infrastructure of this lower half of the country has been disrupted. The hatred is growing. People have no hope for a future today. despite all the propaganda we're getting here. We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest, Joel Skousen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and right now we have Mark calling in from Pennsylvania. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Hey, good, good. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question for your guest here. I'm having trouble. I've read some books and also, you know, heard some radio shows, and including yours, and I pretty much support you too, Dr. Stan, by the way. But anyway, I have trouble. Maybe your guest and even you, Dr. Stan, can help me out on this. I've been discussing with my friends about, you know, how the current administration here in the United States is pretty much globalistic in nature, but then at the same time, the same friends of mine that I'm telling this to, you know, they bring up stuff like, well, number one, we were taken out of the International Criminal Court. They use stuff like that. Something else they like to use is that the only reason Bush, goes to the international community if it suits him, that's the only reason he'll do it. He's isolationist, unilateralist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you counter that?
All right, Joel, why don't you explain that?
Well, I think he's got a very good point. I run into the same thing when I talk to people. In reality, they are both. It's part of the Hegelian dialectic, that is, that you play one side in order to switch sides. For example, they start out by being unilateralist in order to cause the major opposition in the United States, including many conservatives, to say, we've got to get this administration to talk to our international arm, we've got to get them to talk to the UN and to get their permission for things. In other words, you antagonize your opposition by being unilateral, then you react to the backlash, the demand for working with the UN, and then you go wholeheartedly into the arms of the UN. But you see, it's hard to prove people that they're doing that purposely, because this is a very sophisticated deception. These people claim to be in favor of U.S. sovereignty. Like the International Criminal Court, for example, they do this because they want to make sure that they do not get declared war criminals. In other words, there's a certain amount of protection. You watch at the time when they get in and control the United Nations at the administrative level, then they will be for the International Criminal Court. So it's, the problem is you've got to watch them over a long period of time to see what their true intentions are. We're only halfway through the battle when they're starting to say, you know, we're not for the International Criminal Court. When they get someone like Bill Clinton to be
hold that thought right there.
Secretary General, then they'll be for it.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We have Mark calling in from Pennsylvania saying, well, how can we convince my friends that we're globalist when, after all, Bush has come out against the International Criminal Court, and he's going alone. He's not going to the rest of the world to get behind him. He's saying, well, what's good for America, we're going to do, irrespective of the rest of the world. So anything else you wanted to point out there? Of course, Joel's response was, this is the dialectic. You have to have two sides fighting one another, the idea of a thesis, an antithesis, or an antithesis, and then, of course, you come up with a new synthesis. And, of course, this is the standard Hegelian technique, and these are the ideas put forward.
Let me put out one other thing, Dr. Stan. Ron Paul had a piece of legislation in there about pulling out of the United Nations, and it went down to defeat in the United, and the Bush administration fought against it tooth and nail, and so did the entire Republican establishment. So if you really were against the international community, if you really wanted to make a stand for national sovereignty, you would have supported Ron Paul's bill. So that's one of the direct pieces of evidence that they had no intention of really fighting against the globalist proposition.
Now, am I mistaken, or did we eventually, recently, after the Abu Ghraib fiasco, come forward and say, well, we will, of course, then submit ourselves to the International Criminal Court? Am I mistaken on that? Or
yes, not? Yeah, the U.S. has not acceded to anything on the International Criminal Court.
All right. Mark, I think that Joel is absolutely right. I think they're playing games with our reality. But I think as things get worse and worse here, and of course I believe we are moving towards World War III, I think that before this is all over, the American people are going to be pleading for a world government just so we can have some sort of stability, because that's what happened to Europe after the First World War. I mean, they were willing to give up everything for the League of Nations. And the same thing after the Second World War. I mean, they were desperate for some sort of stability because of the horror of that war. I mean, 40, 50 million people died in the Second World War. And, of course, the people were willing to do anything. The American people have not been hurt badly enough. Before this is over, they will be. But I think, first of all, if they're not globalists, why is it that they're refusing to close our borders and doing everything they can to make the illegal aliens legal? Why is it they are pushing this free trade zone of the Americas? That's an internationalist program. Why are we actually encouraging the European Union and creating a strong competitor, which may very well have a currency that will supplant our own? Why is it that we continue, you know, still to pay, I think, about 25% of the fees of the United Nations? Why did the Bush administration rejoin UNESCO? And, of course, I think it was the Secretary of Education or Commerce who said, now, of course, we can train our citizens, children to be world citizens. Why is the entire thrust of the No Child Left Behind program to condition our children to support the United Nations? And if you haven't seen the 4-tape set or the book Fed Ed, you need to get it to see what they're indoctrinating our kids in. So that'll give you a few answers. How's that?
Oh, well, very good. And can I have just one more question?
Sure, you can.
And you know, if you don't want to answer it, I understand. I heard one of your guests, Dr. Stan, I think it was on Monday of this week, talking about Osama bin Laden, and someone called in a caller and asked the guest if he thought that Osama was some type of an asset to the United States, asset to the CIA or whatever, and your guest denied that. I've read in other places on the net and elsewhere that is a strong possibility that it is the case. Do you guys know anything about that? If you don't, I'll just hang up.
All right, fine. I'll let Joel answer that one. And of course, the question is there anything to suggest that Osama bin Laden might, of course, not be what he purports to be, but that Osama bin Laden might actually be and somehow working for the CIA? How would you respond to that, Joel?
Well, I'd say there's significant general evidence to that effect. There's a few pieces of specific evidence. One of them is, of course, the multiple times, this is a series of evidences, multiple times in which, from the Clinton administration through this current Bush administration, specific people have come forth with specific intelligence on the location of Osama bin Laden. The U.S. has refused to capture him or accede to the offers of foreign governments to turn Osama bin Laden over to the United States. There is the evidence as well that CIA station chief in Dubai met with Osama bin Laden. That's a direct indication reported by France Presse Internationale that he was an asset. He was, of course, an asset admitted by the CIA. They were giving him funding originally, and they claim they lost control, but there's no real evidence of that. The highest general piece of evidence is the fact that Al-Qaeda, as supposedly the largest and most well-funded terrorist organization in the world, has been unable to penetrate, according to facts on the ground, our borders, which are porous and easy to get through, and do any normal acts of terrorism of the normal small variety, like car bombing, suicide bombing, or bombing of any of the 100,000 electrical pylons out completely unprotected in the United States.
Or derailing a train out in the middle of the desert sometimes.
Right. In other words, how is it that they only do high-profile events to give governments the ability to justify taking away constitutional liberties and don't do any normal terrorism, which would prove that the government is inept and incapable of defending America? That's what would bring down or make our government unpopular, is if they did small random attacks, of which there is no defense. But those small random attacks don't give the government the excuse to shut down the entire airline industry or to control all the access to the airlines that they're concentrating on now.
And I would suggest anybody who'd like to know about Osama bin Laden needs to get Richard Miniter's book, Losing Bin Laden, where 11 separate times we could have taken him out. The president ordered the intelligence agencies to take out Osama bin Laden. They absolutely refused. And then we went into Afghanistan. Once again, we didn't try to get bin Laden. And anybody questions that, we have a wonderful article we'll send you from the Washington Times. October 7th, 2001, just a few days after we went in, where a high government official stated, we're not going in after Osama bin Laden. Our policy is not to get Osama bin Laden. If we get Osama bin Laden, how would we justify this war? So I hope that'll answer your question. And let's go to Ken, who's calling from Seal Beach. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Well, first, I'd like to make a point on the aides with Arafat. There was a gentleman who was working in an office I was working in many years ago, and in the 1980s, actually, and 1984, he collapsed. He went into a coma, and he had the low blood count. He also had the dementia, and he was dead in exactly 1 week, exactly the same as this man after he went into the coma. So I think there's a very good possibility they did have AIDS. And anyway, I'm going to go on to a question. There's approximately $1 billion of Arafat's money, or money that he stole, that is in Swiss banks right now. And, of course, I understand that his so-called wife is getting several million dollars a year. Is there a possibility that that money can be transferred back to the Palestinians? What do you think?
Joel?
I would say the chances of that are very, very slim. And the reason is that Arafat kept very, very tight control, secret control of that bank account. It was set up for him by the Israelis. So the Israelis know how to get access to that. They may well have gone in and taken the money, transferred it out so that they can use it as a bargaining chip. So I don't think that they're going to, that's going to be easily accessible. One of the things, and here's the longer version of the story, why would Israel have set up a slush fund account for Arafat? It's a little bit complex, but one of the reasons was the Israeli government or any of those, even though they pretend to be operating for Israeli interest, in fact, are working for globalist interests. And one of the globalist interests has been to maintain Arafat and to control Arafat, and using the lure of money is one way that they're able to do that. They may use that as a carrot to control the next Arafat who's in charge of the Palestinian Authority, whether it's Abu Mazen or Abu Allah. In any case, I don't think that anyone's going to get access to that without going through the Israelis, and of course nothing like that will come out in the normal press. What the Palestinians will have access to is several other billions of dollars that Arafat and his cronies together invested in, as I say, hotels and villas and business operations around the world that are producing income, not going to the Palestinian people who are starving to death, and but basically to keep the hierarchy of terrorism in the funds that they need.
How's that for an answer, Ken?
Excellent answer. Thank you very much.
Fine. Thank you. And, of course, the thing is AIDS, Arafat and AIDS, I don't know whether they had AIDS or not. What I think is so significant, though, is if you go on the Internet, you'll find all these articles, and yet when you read the New York Times or the Washington Post or the general publications put out by the media establishment, not one word of that, not even a suggestion that some people had said that. So you could not ignore that unintentionally. There has to be an intentional cover-up. They could say, we find that this is certainly no basis for this. This is hysteria. This is right-wing paranoia. These people believe in dark helicopters. They don't even do that. They totally ignore all the stories up there on the Internet. And, of course, where there's so much smoke, well, there probably is a little bit of fire there. Okay, Joel, why don't you go right ahead?
Well, let's switch to the U.S. economy now. We're getting a lot of mixed signals in the economy. The big news, of course, is that the dollar has continued to slide relative to other important currencies such as the Swiss franc, the euro, and the yen. The dollar reached a historic low this week against the euro, finally crossing the $1.30 mark. This, of course, is natural, considering the rate at which the Bush administration continues to deficit spend with near abandon. The Federal Reserve is accommodating this easy money policy by holding down interest rates way below the natural rate of interest, which is about 6 to 8%. That's what it would take to keep pace with real inflation. The U.S. continues to understate inflation via manipulated consumer price index, the CPI, and also now they're manipulating the producer's price wholesale index, the PPI, which is a much more accurate one than the CPI. People were beginning to look at only the PPI because the CPI was skewed, so this past year they stopped producing the PPI figures and said we're doing some modifications and we'll come out with an adjusted figure, and ever since it's been about 10 to 20% lower. In other words, masking the effects of inflation. But, you know, the markets aren't really fooled, especially currency traders. If it weren't for the central banks in Japan, Europe, and China intervening to buy dollar-denominated treasury bills, the dollar would be in an even steeper decline. Now, much has been made the case on internet sites about the imminent collapse of the dollar as oil-producing nations threaten to switch to the euro as a currency of trade. I want to analyze this a little bit with your listeners. We must keep in perspective that these same nations already have billions of dollars sitting in their own banks as reserves. If they start dumping dollars on the market at a rapid pace, those dollar reserves that still are in the bank, because they can't get rid of them all at once, would fall rapidly, and those reserve holdings would lose significant value. Now, this factor ensures, Dr. Stan, that the transition away from the dollar will take many years. In the meantime, the U.S. continues to pressure Latin American states to take on the dollar as an official currency. This is kind of a hedge strategy so that the U.S. loses some nation using the dollar and transfers those dollars to other nations. This way, the U.S. maintains a large number of dollar-holding states who can help absorb U.S. inflation. Few other countries, you know, have had this advantage, Dr. Stan, of being able to print what would normally make us a banana republic, high inflation country, and export those dollars around the world. And we also have the factor that we have natural price deflation that comes from buying cheaper and cheaper products each year from Asia, and that masks the effects of inflation here at home. Now, there's a few other signals of increased weakness in the economy. There are more layoffs by big companies. Delta Airlines is nearing bankruptcy, is laying off thousands of people. Ross Perot's company, EDS, has been laying off some 20,000 people. FBC Communications, one of the largest telephone companies in the U.S., will cut 6% of its workforce next year. Retail sales numbers are slowing. In other words, we have a split economy, some portions booming who are downstream of military or government spending, and others that are in decline. So it depends on which stream that you get your money through, whether or not you're in recession or a boom.
Well, there was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was just yesterday, where they said that the Bush administration was going to talk up the dollar as they watched it and allowed it to slide. So on one hand, they're going to say the dollar is getting stronger. On the other hand, they're intentionally going to lower it so that our goods will be more competitive on the world market. The only trouble is the Chinese, of course, have pegged their currency to ours. So as we drop our currency, their currency drops, and we get no advantage from it, at least as far as our trade with communist China.
Well, and China's doing that, of course, on purpose. China is the rest of my analysis this week. It's got its own huge bubble, and there are many signs of weakness within the Chinese economy. A lot of corruption, a lot of government and manipulation. You know, everyone keeps talking about China being a true free market under a communist country. As much as we'd like to believe that China represents a rip-roaring free market economy, the implications of what's happening are real. The fact is China's economy is still 50 to 70% centrally planned. Centrally planned economies are prone to shortages and bottlenecks, and that's what we're seeing in China. Huge shortages of material, shortages of workers, shortages of electricity especially. Factories in the inland are having to shut down 2 or 3 days a week. It's becoming very difficult to meet their production goals. So in China, almost every investment involves a government decision, political influence, or semi-official payoff. And even then, we still have companies, you know, head over heels longing to move their factories overseas. And a lot of it isn't just for the cheaper workers. A lot of it's because they don't have to deal with OSHA, government regulations, the litigation reputation that we have here in the United States.
And I think one of the interesting things, I remember being told by a congressman one time that the countries investing in China have been guaranteed if their factories are ever nationalized, they'll be paid back not an equal amount of money by our own government, but double or triple of what they actually had invested. So there's every incentive for people to invest over there and, of course, harness that cheap labor, almost like our leaders had a death wish.
That's right, and as the Economist magazine reported, China's banks have been little more than conduits for pouring money into local governments and state-owned companies. It's not just the free market, or the not free market, the major corporations moving over to China that have been getting money. And a lot of bad debt, looking at a lot of foreclosures, a lot of that's been swept under the rug. So China's economy is not well, and if it goes, we could have problems too.
And of course, I think a lot of the currencies, a lot of the economies, Philippines are having real problems with debt. Europe is having a lot of problems with debt. And I sort of suspect we're sort of the end of this cycle, and I think that, well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. But I suspect in the next year or so we're going to see the real contraction. Would you think that would be the case?
Well, except that they can still inflate a lot more in order to stave that off, so I'm not sure that that's in the cards yet.
All right, we'll hold off here, and we'll be right back with Joel Skousen. Well, Dr. Stan, we've got Tony calling from SoCal. Tony, do you have a quick question? We've just got 3 minutes to go.
Oh, I think I can make it fast. I think this is up Mr. Skousen's alley, though. Back during the Clinton administration, I remember a lot of talk coming out of China about how they were going to use economic warfare to destroy us and not necessarily military. And part of their strategy was sabotage of our financial systems. And I've been reading a lot lately that the Chinese are using the currency link between the, I think it's pronounced yuan, and the dollar to their advantage, and they're quite prepared to de-link and let their currency float just to destroy our economy.
All right,
I was wondering if you'd comment on that.
Would you like to comment on what Tony's saying?
No, I really think that was a bunch of disinformation that came out, Tony. The reason is that the Chinese need our economic inflows in order to build their military establishment. They're not anywhere near built yet, so they won't be delinking and stopping the support of the American dollar through buying T-bills, which the U.S. Depends on selling about $3 billion a day to foreign banks, and most of those are central banks. So I think that China's only covering for their military buildup by saying that they're going to use only economic warfare. Indeed, they could do that, but they would have to work in concert with the Japanese as well, which they don't get along very well with the Japanese. So I think that's misinformation. I think we're about 5 or 6 years away from them coming up to a position of military hegemony where they can sever the ties with American industry that they desperately need right now.
But I think we're making a terrible mistake by becoming so dependent upon Communist China.
Absolutely.
And other countries to buy our debt. Because if those countries stop buying our debt, then they, of course, have to start printing money, inflate our money supply, and, of course, we do become a banana republic. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here in the next 6 months to a year.
And the reason they do, of course, buy our debt is that they want to keep the American spending going, because the Japanese and the European economy are driven by American purchases of their goods.
In fact, when I read in the Bible about the last Babylon the great has fallen, and the merchants of the world weep, that Babylon is no longer there. I wonder if it is applicable to our time, who Babylon would be. Joel, we're out of time. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us, and I think we have a program again tomorrow.
Yes, look forward to it, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Joel, let's get your number out. Well, we didn't get his number. Anyway, if you want to know how to get hold of Joel, why, give us a call, and we'll certainly tell you how to get in touch with Joel Skousen. Well, that was Joel Skousen. My favorite guests here. And if you'd like to know how to get in touch with him or get in touch with his organization, of course, you can go to his website, which is worldaffairsbrief.com. Worldaffairsbrief.com, you can sign on there and sign up to get certainly a copy of his publication. If you don't have access, you can call 877-996-4327, extension 100. That's 877-996-4327, 4327, extension 100, and ask them how you can get a free copy of the Joel Skousen World Affairs Brief. And if you like it, I think you'll want to subscribe to it. I will tell you, every day after I check a couple of other things and read my emails, I go to World Affairs Brief just to see what's really going on in the world. They're doing a great job. Well, this is the time I want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty, of course, is listener-supported. We actually do carry the Big Berkey and the Berkey Light water filters, and somebody had asked last week if they would filter out radioactive material. And so I talked to them today, and of course, as the man who produces and circulates these said, Jim Shepherd, water cannot become radioactive. It's the dust in the water that's radioactive, and of course your filters will filter that out, but your filters will become radioactive after a while, so you want to be careful handling them, but of course you have good potable water. So if you don't have a Big Berkey or a Berkey Light and you'd like more information, go to our website or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, and you'll learn all about the Big Berkey and the Berkey Light filters. The one thing that I learned talking about this is you want to have an extra set of filters on hand, because actually it would take, if there was an airburst or even a land burst, why, of course, your filters would do a good job for a couple of weeks anyway, but then they become radioactive, so you'd want to be able to set those aside for a time and put some fresh filters in. So we're going to get an extra set of filters just to have them on hand, and I think that you should give serious consideration to that too. If you have not yet read Igor Shafid's book, The Inside the Red Zone, you need to get it. You need to go through his list of all the things to have on hand. We're entering terrible and perilous times. If you're reading the material being put out by the people from the Project for the New American Century, they get beating the drums for going to war with Iran and with Saudi Arabia, or at least replacing the regimes there. So be prepared for difficult times and just hope and pray you never need the items that you put together. But you need Igor Shafid's book. You need to get yourself a suitcase, put everything in it, and you may never take it out of the house. But if something bad happens, you'll know where the things that you need are, and they'll be available to you. Again, the number to get Igor Shafid's book, Inside the Red Zone, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Great new tape sets, the Operation Paperclip, Depleted Uranium, and of course we have so many others, about the organized effort to poison the American people. And if you haven't had a 4-tape set on fluoride, on mercury, on aspartame, or haven't read Dr. Blaylock's excellent book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, why you really need to get them. You need to understand what they're doing to us, what they're doing to our children, what they're doing to generations yet unborn. You've got to be pretty evil to do what's actually going on today, to put things into the water and into the food that can create illness and infertility and lower the testosterone level in men, and reason so many men are having difficulties today with sexual function is because the testosterone has been lowered by fluoride, by aspartame. And isn't it amazing that nobody tells you that? Well, we're out of time. Just pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our listeners and, pardon me, for our ministers and our leaders. But please pray for Radio Liberty. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Pastor Ted Pike. He's a minister up in Oregon, about 20 miles south of Portland. And, of course, he and his father before him were ministers. They were instrumental in getting the day of prayer declared here in the United States. But we're going to be talking this evening about the hate crime legislation that they have in Canada, the hate crime legislation they're trying to get through here in the United States. And they're going to get it through, believe me. And, of course, you can forget about the First Amendment if that happens. And the only thing that's going to stop it is an aroused and really angry American public who's going to let their members of Congress know we're not going to put up with any further infringements on our Bill of Rights. And, of course, I don't believe anything harm should come to anybody who's a homosexual. We may disagree with their lifestyle, but God loves them, too. And, of course, we would do everything we could to try to bring them out of this degenerate lifestyle, because this is what it is. However, if that law were to pass and I was to call homosexuality a degenerate activity, why, of course, I would be subject to hate crime and probably fines and imprisonment. So, with that as the background, Pastor Ted Pike, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
It's my privilege.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how it was that you got involved in this battle, almost like Paul Revere riding through the night telling people the Redcoats are coming. Well, you're out there telling people across America the hate crimes legislation is coming, and if that is able to get through, why you can forget about the freedoms we have in our Constitution.
Yes. Well, I have been involved in political activity almost from my childhood. As you were mentioning, my father was a prominent leader here in the Pacific Northwest, a conservative leader back before it was popular to be conservatives, back in the Goldwater era and so on of the early 60s. And we as a family were instrumental in helping reestablish the National Day of Prayer back around 1980. My father was aware, quite painfully aware, that the great National Day of Prayer had fallen into disuse, was no longer observed by the government and the American people. So we had an old airplane, an old antique airplane, and we put a big banner on that airplane and a big loudspeaker, and we flew it all across America, clear up by New York, down throughout the South, towing this big banner saying, "Pray for America." We went to patriotic rallies and so on, and we whipped up a lot of interest, a lot of signatures, petitions, and so on, and we got the attention of the religious liaison to the President Reagan, Morton Blackwell, and my father insisted that he tell the president that we must reestablish the National Day of Prayer. So 2 weeks later, my father was invited to the White House for a big ceremonial signing of the National Day of Prayer, and that's how the National Day of Prayer got started. Again, Bill Bright and Campus Crusades and then the Dobsons and so on made it a national institution. But out of that, we created a watchdog organization called the National Prayer Network, which is dedicated to awakening, standing on the wall, if you will, sounding the alarm concerning a grievous moral issues, problems facing the church and the conservative movement. And out of that, I became aware in the late 80s of the threat of anti-hate laws. And what I did was I began to research what was happening in Canada.
Hold that thought right there for a moment, Ted. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Ted Pike. We're going to be talking about, of course, his efforts to awaken people to the very real danger and the implications of the anti-hate laws, which are simply another nail in the coffin of what's going on. I mean, after all, if we had the anti-hate laws, you wouldn't be able to point out that 80% of the lodges of the mosques here in the United States were, of course, preaching hatred to the Muslims here, because you wouldn't be able to say anything against Muslims or anybody else. Hateful speech, oh my goodness. You wouldn't be able to be critical of the corrupt politicians. That would engender hate. You don't know what you would be as subject to. And of course, one of the things would be, you would not be able to say that homosexuality is bad. It is against law, God's law. Because that would, of course, might hurt the feelings of a homosexual. And yet, of course, that's the one thing that would bring them to salvation and save their lives. So you pick up the story, Ted, you were saying that you began to then to research what was happening in Canada and the implications of what had happened here. Well, what's actually happened in Canada since they put in their anti-hate laws?
Yes. Back around 1971, the Canadian hate law, anti-hate law, was established. And I should mention that I have been a student of how the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith has been the godfather, the inspiration, the inventor of the whole idea of hate laws. They clear back even in the late 80s, they had a national student anti-hate law, model anti-hate law competition, and they were working very, very hard to create a model anti-hate statute which could be used both on the state and the federal level. But as early as 1965, B'nai B'rith Canada, this is a huge Jewish fraternal organization around the world, working for the establishment of so-called anti-hate laws in the Americas and in Europe. They badgered the parliament again and again, lobbying. It was very well publicized. The B'nai B'rith Canada was working hard, even in the late 60s, to establish an anti-hate law in Canada. They succeeded in 1971 with establishing the Human Rights Act of Canada, and Section 319 of the Human Rights Act makes it a criminal offense to criticize a certain protected identifiable groups in Canada, which include homosexuals. And that's why in Canada right now, if you were to stand out on the street corner or even on a radio program even in the pulpit and to criticize homosexuality in specific terms, for example, if you were to say that homosexuals have a higher rate of AIDS than the rest of the population, you could be indicted under their hate law.
Well, of course, the tragedy of this whole thing is the Anti-Defamation League is doing nothing but generating anti-Semitism, and by doing the things that they do, they actually get more and more people really resentful and turning them against Jewish people. And I don't believe this has anything to do, the Anti-Defamation League or B'nai B'rith has anything to do with Jewry. I think it is basically Luciferian. I think it has its foundations in the occult. And until people understand that there are these occult forces working within the Jewish religion, within the Catholic religion, within the Protestant religion, and certainly the Muslim religion itself, by its very essence, is Luciferian, is satanic. Certainly Muhammad believed he was devil-possessed, and if, you can, of course, get the information, the documentation on that, and the wonderful four tapes we have, tapes that we have called Islam, the religion of doom, and you'll actually find where in the various writings and Muhammadan writings Muhammad said, I am demon possessed, I fear I am demon possessed. So until we recognize that these spiritual forces working behind the scenes, we can't see what it is that is, of course, creating the problems that our society faces today. And so in Canada they got this anti-hate law passed. Now, did that also include criticism of Jews and other groups?
Yes. The general idea prevailing in the liberal establishment, the justice systems of the Western world, is that Christians, white Anglo-Saxon Christians and so on, have been responsible for such terrible oppressions against blacks and homosexuals and Jews and Indians and Chicanos. The list goes on, that these groups deserve special protection under the law. And
but of course, these are speech laws. These are not action laws. These are speech laws. And what they're really doing, of course, is engendering a hatred on the part of the majority white population, which is exactly what they want. Turn one group against the other, and of course, eventually you're going to have people coming out with clubs. And that's what they want as we move from into a period, the coming period, I believe, of chaos and crisis.
Yes. Yes, and there are a number of established groups listed in Canada, including Indians in Canada, and if you specifically criticize them, the issue is not whether what you say about them is true or not. I mean, the fact that homosexuals do have a higher rate of AIDS is uncontestable and scientifically demonstrated, but in the Canadian Tribunal hate crimes system, the only evidence which will be admitted into court is whether or not that individual, that member of that group, has had his feelings hurt, whether he has been traumatized by your words. And if it can be established that his feelings have been hurt, then you are in big trouble. For example, up in Saskatchewan in 2001, an evangelical Christian, Hugh Owens, did nothing more than put four Bible verses which were critical of homosexuality in the local newspaper, the Star Phoenix. Two homosexuals complained that their feelings were hurt, and Hugh Owens was fined $6,000. The newspaper was fined $6,000 for the hate crime of intimidating homosexuals.
You see, it wouldn't intimidate them at all. I mean, if you care about homosexuals, you're going to tell them what you're doing is going to kill you. What you're going to doing is going to eventually end you up in hell.
Yes.
Don't you realize that there is eternal punishment? There is salvation for turning from your wicked ways and accepting the Lord. So if you care about homosexuals, you're going to tell them the truth. And what you're doing effectively is keeping people from telling the truth, from saving their lives. But behind this whole thing, I believe, of course, the Luciferian forces, which will claim as many souls as possible for eternal damnation.
Yes. In Canada, what you have, though, is rather than these so-called anti-hate laws bringing peace and tolerance and fair play, actually, the persons they do intimidate is the Christians. The Christians are the most intimidated of any group in Canada. And, for example, just last year over in Alberta, a Christian school, a Christian private school, discovered they had a homosexual on their faculty. They tried to fire him. He complained to the Human Rights Tribunal that the church school was forced to keep him on their faculty under penalty of imprisonments and large fines. So what we have here is a real thrust against the free speech and the free exercise of religious conviction upon Christians.
Well, of course, the Canadian people have brought it on themselves. They have not been involved. Most of them would rather just sit around and watch television rather than get involved, because the other side is dedicated, and of course, the good people lose when they do nothing.
Yes, and the problem is here, the same thing is happening here in the United States. The ADL, B'nai B'rith, have taken away free speech in Canada, and now they are proposing to do the very same thing here in America. And what they are doing is they are creating a false idea that bias against homosexuality equals hate. And here's an interesting historical fact. Back around the beginning of the Clinton administration in the early 90s, Janet Reno, Attorney General, gave to the ADL the sole privilege of defining what hate was for the American people, for the justice system, the FBI, and every police department in America. And today, in your local police department, wherever you are, you will find training manuals, anti-hate training manuals. They'll have sensitivity training sessions. They will have anti-hate training videos. The police are being indoctrinated in America today to believe that bias against homosexuality equals hate. And therefore, if you have that kind of federal endorsement of the ADL program and federal endorsement of this very twisted definition of what hate and a hate crime is, you're going to have real persecution of Christians coming up in the in the years ahead.
Well, of course, this is not law yet, but I'm sure that they would like to get this legislation through. But then what would you expect from Janet Reno? She was a lesbian, and of course, there were lesbians working right in the White House, in fact, sleeping in the same bed with the president.
Yes.
I have a video that was shot the day that Clinton was inaugurated. A group of homosexuals, demonstrating, and this one woman is up there on the podium saying, well, we have information that the First Lady had an affair with one of us when, of course, she was in college. So that's maybe why Hillary is not worried about Bill running around with other women all the time.
Yes. Well, the truth is that the ADL in the early 90s were successful in creating a model anti-hate bill. They used this this model legislation to convince 48 out of the 50 states to adopt some version of their anti-hate bill. And while we don't have a federal anti-hate program as now exists in Canada, we don't quite have that. We do have 48 out of the 50 states, including your state of California, with a so-called anti-intimidation law, a hate law, very similar to what could be in Canada. It hasn't been as fully developed and as fully adjudicated and enforced as in Canada yet. But on the state law level, we have these hate laws which have a lot of teeth, which can tend to come down any minute upon Christians. And in fact, this is what happened on October 10th, two days after the big hate bill was defeated in Congress this year. The hate crime squad in Philadelphia descended on 11 Christians who were peacefully witnessing at a huge gay pride parade in Philadelphia. They arrested them for three felonies, four misdemeanors, a total of 47 years in prison if convicted. They threw them in jail for 21 hours, and now these 11 Christians stand awaiting a preliminary arraignment on December 13th. And that's an example of how that, even though we don't have a federal bill quite yet, state hate laws are plenty nasty, and they are very anti-Christian.
Well, of course, there is a conspiracy against Christianity. That should be so obvious from the positions taken by our Supreme Court. And the amazing thing is that nobody wants to talk about it. Our Christian leaders won't talk about it. Certainly our conservative leaders won't talk about it. But, of course, everything going on today, if you trace it back, is part of this eternal conspiracy against God.
Yes. Well, I have been very concerned since June 15th of this year in particular. Usually we can expect a more conservative Republican majority in the Senate to continue to resist this Big Brother Orwellian legislation. It's been introduced by the ADL three times, and narrowly, I have been working actively all three times, doing broadcasts, distributing brochures, and we've made an excellent video documentary against this on this topic. And anyway, on June 15th of this year, suddenly 18 Republicans went over and voted with the Democrats in favor of this big bill. It's the Local Law Enforcement Enhancement Act, and I was very, very alarmed about that. And I have been on talk shows all summer long, dozens of talk shows sounding the alarm.
But of course, why would you be surprised at that? The Bush administration defeated a conservative Christian running with the Republican primary for Senate in Pennsylvania, and backed, of course, the liberal pro-choice, pro-homosexual Arlen Specter 2 years earlier. They got rid of Bob Smith, who was a fundamentalist, I shouldn't say fundamentalist Christian, he was a very conservative Catholic in New Hampshire, of course, they put in Sununu, who is exactly a clone of Specter. So the Bush administration has done everything they could to skew the Republican majority in the Senate towards the liberal side.
Well, President Bush has said that he will sign off some kind of hate bill, a modified hate bill. So what we have to do is depend on the American people, especially this winter, to get educated, to sound the alarm and protest to their elected representatives in Congress.
All right. Well, when we get back, of course, we're going to invite calls at 24 Liberty. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. When we get back, well, we're going to tell you how to get hold of Ted Pike, get a hold of the material he has, and, of course, get people to understand that America is in real trouble. There is a conspiracy against God. There is a conspiracy against Christians. And if we don't stand up and be counted now and say no, we may very well soon be on our knees saying yes. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Ted Pike, and we're talking about the impending hate legislation. When do you anticipate this will be brought up in the Senate?
Well, here's the situation. We had some feisty Republicans controlling the House Majority Leadership this year, and this big hate bill had been tagged on to a big arms bill, and therefore it went into conference between the Senate and the House in September and October to determine whether the hate bill would be kept on as a rider on the big arms bill. Unfortunately, these feisty Republicans were able to hand-pick the members of that is the conferees, and they were able to defeat this bill. However, here is the ominous news. Here is something that every Christian America should be very, very concerned about. A majority of Republicans in the House of Representatives on September 28th made a non-binding but symbolic vote in favor of the hate bill by a majority of 213 to 186. They basically sent a message to the ADL that they would vote for their hate bill when it is reintroduced early in the spring. And so they are joining their colleagues in the Senate, where the vote was 65 to 33. And what this means, folks, is that this hate bill, this Orwellian Big Brother speech crime legislation establishing a thought crimes bureaucracy, will be established next spring unless there is a volcanic upheaval of protest by the American people against it. And this is not, it might be, it will be. These senators and congressmen have made a solemn pledge to the ADL and to the homosexual lobby that they will finally bring in the big hate bill, and we will have an anti-hate bureaucracy like Canada starting next spring.
What sort of response are you getting as you go across America and doing talk programs and telling people about this sort of thing?
Well, it's very interesting. Most people are not taking the anti-hate laws seriously. In fact, a poll was taken of evangelical Christian youth, high school students, and 80% of Christian high school students are in favor of anti-hate laws.
Well, I think that shows what a great job our Christian ministers are doing, teaching them about our Constitution, that once you allow the government to be able to control what you say on one thing, they can control what you say on everything. And if you won't come out and say homosexuality is wrong, what will you say is wrong?
That's right. And the students, young people, college students today, even in the church, are being saturated and bombarded in their schooling, their secular educations, with this idea that we must have respect for diversity, we must not be judgmental, we must not be critical, and so on, of people in alternate lifestyles. And what this has done is it's resulted in an idea that, well, hate laws are good. You know, Jesus was against hate. The Bible's against hate. What they don't realize is that is a word game is being put. The ADL's definition of hate is not the same as Webster's. It's not the same as the Bible's. The ADL says that bias against homosexuality is hate. Now, there's no document on this earth as biased against homosexuality as the Holy Bible.
And you see, the ADL and the B'nai B'rith are supposedly represented the Jewish position, and the Jewish position, traditional Jewish position in the Bible is that this is a sin against God.
Of
and, of course, in the Old Testament, they stone homosexuals. So, obviously, the ADL and the B'nai B'rith do not represent the Jewish position. They represent the Luciferian position.
Absolutely.
Because behind homosexuality is a strong spiritual force, a force of organized evil, the mirror image of everything God planned. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Ted Pike, and I'm going to ask Ted to get his telephone number out and tell people how to get in touch with him, his website, so that if you're interested in helping him get the information out and helping people to understand what this is about, the impact of homosexuality creating depravity in every society it's ever existed in, and, of course, there's no incidence in all history where a nation is accepted or turned to homosexuality, where God has now eventually turned on that nation and destroyed it. And believe me, as sure as God is just, his justice will not sleep forever. Ted, how can people get in touch with you and help you in what you're doing?
Yes, as I was saying, we have got to get educated fast, Doctor. The problem has been that the people have not been educated. This is a very confusing issue because the very definitions are skewed, twisted, upside down. The ADL is changing the times and laws and the definitions and terms of the most fundamental principles and values, and therefore people are very, very confused about hate laws.
Well, I would think they would be. I don't know if you probably didn't watch Law and Order last night, but it's one of the most popular programs on television. It was all about this gay marriage and of course the rights of gays to get married and how intolerant it was, and just the radical right, the radical Christians, they're against homosexuals having the right to love one another. It's all about love. It's not about love at all. I mean, if you study the history of homosexual relations, and I have books written by homosexuals on it, not one of them lasts more than 10 years. None of them are mutually faithful because, of course, this is an obsession with sex and depravity. It has nothing to do with this idea of love. And, of course, there's so much violence and so much unhappiness in the homosexual lifestyle, and the solution is, of course, not to condone it. It is not gay. It is tragic. They're miserable. And, of course, the hope for every homosexual is a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And it's easy for me to say, and I know this is a sexual addiction, but people can come out of this lifestyle, and we have to tell them that.
Yes. Well, the Christian community is quite confused about this issue. They, fortunately, thank God, they are not confused that a man and a woman constitute the proper relationship and the proper definition of marriage. And they voted very resoundingly in favor of that very simple idea. The problem with the hate laws legislation is it's so twisted. It is so devious and cunning and subtle that the Christians and Christian leaders haven't been able to figure it out, how to untangle it and get it all straightened out. And therefore, they're really sitting ducks as the Christians were in Canada for the gradual encroachments of these anti-hate laws. Now, I have a video. I was so concerned about this subject that we made an 80-minute, an exciting, interesting documentary, fully documented in Canada and the United States, on the whole subject of hate crimes legislation, the history of it, how it has ended free speech in Canada, what the ADL wants to do here in the United States through state and federal laws. And this 80-minute documentary is available on our website, and our website is www.hatelawsexposed.org. That's www.hatelawsexposed.org. You can actually watch 7 minutes of streaming video of this documentary, and it's only $25. You can order online, or you can just call me at 503-631-3808. That's 503-631-3808, and we will take your credit card number and fire you off a copy. Now, this video is so important that your pastor, your church, your Sunday school class, watch it and get educated now during the winter, and sound off and call your representatives in Congress and tell them. Here's what I'd like you to tell them. And in fact, here is the Capitol hotline. It's 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121. I'd like you to tell them tomorrow. Call your congressman, your senator from your state, and say, 11 Christians have now been arrested in Pennsylvania under the Pennsylvania hate laws. Do not vote for the big federal hate law this summer.
All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, give us a call. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We don't know what's going to happen to the Christians, but, you know, if they can throw them in prison, if they can get them involved in legal entanglement, they can bankrupt them defending themselves against these charges, does it really matter? Other people will be intimidated. And there is an organized effort to destroy Christianity in America. There is a conspiracy against God. And we're going to have to either stand up and be counted or certainly be counted out. So, again, we'd love to hear from you, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and over a quarter of a million homosexuals are dead of AIDS in America because of what they do. Is it, of course, so loving to tell them, go ahead and do what you want to do, there's no harm to it? Or if you really love homosexuals, are you going to tell them there is opportunity, you can get out of this lifestyle, and of course, you do not have to give your life over to your passions, and of course, by telling them that and offering them the hope why they can get out, the people within the homosexual lifestyle are saying, there is no way out, you were born that way, you're made that way, it's in your genes, and it really isn't. It is a lifestyle decision. Yes, there's some men who are far more effeminate than others, but that doesn't mean that they have to be homosexuals in any manner or means at all. And, of course, really the battle is in one's mind. And when you understand that all of our minds are under attack by these Luciferian forces, there really are demonic forces in the world today. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men, and we're losing that battle because we're not prepared to defend ourselves and our faith. Our telephone number, again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, our guest, Ted Pike. Ted, go ahead.
Yes, Doctor, we are very much in a war of ideas, a war of concepts. And the winner of this war is going to be those people, those groups who are in a position to make the definitions of these great terms like hate and love. If they can teach us that hate against homosexuals is... bias against homosexuals equals hate. If they can, on the other hand, if they can teach us that love equals tolerance for fornication and homosexuality and all of that kind of thing, and if they can get that into our minds, especially the minds of the next generation, then they can totally control and totally warp society. And as I was saying earlier, the tragedy is that while the church was unaware of it and the conservatives were unaware of it, The federal government, under Janet Reno in the 90s, endorsed the ADL's, in fact, the ADL made a request to Congress, a specific request in testimony to Congress in 1988, that they, as a veteran civil liberties, quote, civil liberties union, a civil liberties organization, have the right to make the definitions for hate, hate crime, anti-Semitism, all of these terms, so that they could end prejudice in America and establish an anti-hate system similar to Canada. And Janet Reno reciprocated by giving the ADL its request, and so that every police department now in your state, in your community, now is thoroughly indoctrinated
Hold
by
that
the ADL.
Right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Reverend Ted Pike, and we're talking about the hate crime legislation that exists in Canada. Now, similar legislation exists in Europe, it exists in Canada, and it's coming to America. And it's already passed many of our state legislatures, and, of course, people don't understand what's really going on. That, of course, until the knock comes at their door. Freedom is lost when good people do nothing, and all that is necessary for evil to triumph is that good people continue doing what they've done in the past. So if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question, a comment, maybe you disagree. Maybe you think that we should just never be critical of anything about or of anyone or what they're doing. We should just sit back and say, well, if they want to do it, we certainly don't want to regulate what goes on in the bedroom. We're not talking about regulations. We're talking about saying something is wrong. We're talking about a minister getting up and saying homosexuality and immorality is wrong. It's in violation of God's laws, and that will become illegal. It is illegal in Canada. It will become illegal here. So our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Let's go to Herman calling in from Carmel. Hi, Herman. How are you doing?
Good evening. I have a question for our guest. the debate about same-sex marriage, if the amendment passes and in the Constitution to define marriage as between a man and woman, would do you see a problem with having a civil union alternative for homosexual couples so that they can take care of business matters?
No, right, Brian, that the question is, do you see that they should have some sort of a civil relationship so they can take care of business matters? No, we won't call it marriage. We'll just say two homosexuals agree. But, of course, would this be stipulated by law? Why do they need to have a law, Herman? For that, they could have some sort of written agreement. Why does this have to be stipulated in law?
Well, I mean, I think one of the issues was if two have been living together as partners for many years, and then one of them dies, it's for the purposes of inheritance and or medical benefits or pensions or whatever.
Well, why, first of all, why should they, they could sign one another's rights over, but you want them to actually, if one dies, they want to be able to get the pension of the other if they were married?
Well, I'm asking our guest that. Well,
all right, how do you feel about that then, Ted?
I think that homosexuality should be treated as a vice. I think it should be in the category of prostitution, gambling. It should be in the category of vice, not in any way encouraged or endorsed by the government, but in the historical role it should be viewed by the government and taught by the government through health manuals and instructions that this is not good for you. It's not good for your health. It's not good for your partners and so on. And I said that plural because most very, very few homosexual unions are monogamous. They are a very messy affair of lots and lots of people coming and going in sexual contact and so on. No, I don't believe we should give any quarter to the homosexuality by legitimizing it by homosexual unions or any other legal recourse.
All right, Herman, does that answer your question?
Yes, and then you would feel that any ministers who are Christian ministers who do follow that line of giving them these special benefits would be going against biblical teaching.
Oh, absolutely. Homosexuality is an abomination in the eyes of the Lord. And while the Old Testament strictures against it in the sense of capital punishment and so on out of the book of Leviticus do not apply in the age of grace, nevertheless, society, the church, government, all should view it in the same way they view the great vices of society, such as drugs and prostitution and so on.
All right, anything else, Herman?
No, I think you made that clear.
Right, let's go to Dimitri, who's calling. Hi, Dimitri, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I just wanted to add that there was a pretty prominent piece of hate crime legislation that was passed within, I think, 2 months ago, and it was about hate speech. And I just wanted to comment that I wanted to stress the importance of Christians and people who are concerned about it reviewing the text of the laws themselves. I at first reacted very violently to it, but then I sat down and I looked it up. I looked at the text of the law itself, and I noticed in section J and K of the law that speech itself is not sufficient for it to be classified as a crime itself. It must actually be speech threatening to a person's safety or property. And it made me think a little bit more about the process that a law, the process that it takes before a law is actually put into effect, and that it is reviewed by people before it goes in, and that we should be more vigilant about this sort of thing. And if a part of the law or the bill actually, you know, violates something in the Constitution or is that serious, we should call them. But otherwise, when it comes to hate crimes legislation, for the most part, we can rely upon upon the senators to have discernment on this, on these issues, unless, of course, Congress is controlled by the Democrats.
Well, I think that I would be worried to be controlled by the Republicans because they seem to be even more liberal on so many of these issues. Now, the legislation you're speaking of is here in California?
Yes.
Yes, I have read the pretty much the California state anti-intimidation law, and it's virtually identical to Pennsylvania's and Idaho's and others. But the problem here, and I should say you're to be commended for looking into this and becoming more specific about it. Here's the problem. Now, on the state level and in the federal level, a hate crime is defined as a new breed of crime called the crime of intimidation. And in both state and federal laws, intimidation is defined as determining that bias, some kind of bias, motivated some crime against the person or property of another person. And so the crime of intimidation involves two components. It involves bias on one hand, determining bias on one hand, and then on the other hand that some crime of a small or great magnitude has been committed. And therefore, technically speaking, a hate crime or a crime of intimidation cannot be enforced. It cannot be indicted against a person unless the court can prove bias on one hand and an actual crime on the other hand. Now, this is in contrast to our traditional justice system, which says, well, it's enough to determine that some crime has taken place. It's enough to find out who did it. It's enough to punish it in court and go before a jury, and the jury can make judgments about motivation and severity of punishment and so on. That's all very simple. But in the hate crimes tribunal systems of Canada and in European countries, it adds this other very ambiguous element, which is part of the California hate crimes law, and that is determining bias. Now, who determines whether a person is really biased? You have to be a psychologist or even God in order to determine what is bias, who is biased, the extent of their bias, and so on. And therefore, here's the interesting fact about these anti-intimidation laws. Because they are based, because 50% of the definition of a hate crime is very ambiguous, very subjective, and cannot be determined with finality, what happens is, like in Pennsylvania on October 10th, the police have a tendency to just swoop down and gather up people they accuse of bias, they think of bias, are biased, and then get them into court and let the courts sort things out as to whether they are really guilty of the crime of intimidation or not. Now, in Pennsylvania, if you get on the Internet and look at Pennsylvania's law, you'll find it's almost identical to California's. It's the typical ADL anti-hate law. And these legal restraints you're talking about, these legal restraints did not prevent the hate crimes unit of Philadelphia from throwing 11 Christians in the slammer this last month. And in involving them in perhaps hundreds of thousands of dollars of litigation and trials and appeals and so on to get themselves free. The whole hate crimes legal system is built on ambiguity. And we might think that our elected representatives will be watchdogs and keep it from being abused, but in Canada and European countries, it is a wide open door to every kind of police state invasion and abuse and unlawful arrest and imprisonment and so on. And what we have to do is remember, look at what happened on October 10th in Pennsylvania under the jurisdiction of the Pennsylvania hate laws. It's outrageous. It's a violation of our free speech liberty made possible because of such ambiguous definitions and terminology.
I think, Dimitri, the dangerous thing is that the government has no business at all passing legislation. Would you define the term safety? Because you said that, of course, the safety of the homosexual or whoever it was involved with that they were speaking against, how would you define their safety was endangered? And how do you know everybody else will, of course, define it exactly as you would define it?
Well, as I heard from another who described the same law that I reviewed, the quote-unquote victim would have to feel as though that person were preparing an attack of some sort against their safety, or I mean their private property, or their body, or whatever else.
In other words, you would feel that they might, but you don't know that they were going to. In other words, if I were to walk by and look askance at you, and you'd say, well, I thought that the way he was looking at me, he was going to threaten me. Would that mean that I could be put in jail? You see, that is a totally subjective thing. And could you see, could that possibly be misinterpreted or used to intimidate others?
That law in court would have to, in order to be used as a weapon of those who are, you know, trying to get rid of all the people who are just biased against them, you know, the gays who might try to use that, would have to, they'd have to really stretch it in court.
But you see, if they had a sympathetic judge, and then, of course, are you willing to put out $100,000 to defend yourself against that sort of law? Couldn't this be used to intimidate people? Because once you get into court, you're going to have to defend yourself, or you're going to go to prison. So look how this is going to change your whole attitude. You're going to be frightened to do almost anything because you could be taken to court. Under our society, it's not what you somebody else may think that you're going to do, but it's, of course, what you actually do.
Yes,
but this becomes
so
a totally subjective situation.
Yes, I do agree with that.
We have to look at the record. Dimitri, all of these hate laws get in with these promises and the assurances by the ADL that people's rights will be respected and the letter of the law will be felt, observed, and so on. But that's not the way it works out any more than it's working out that way in Pennsylvania right now. What these laws do is they make it, the ambiguity of these laws, as Dr. Monteith has been pointing out, are so vague and so subjective that they create a license for the police, that the hate crime squad, to act with great presumption and great arrogance, because the law is no longer clear and definable. It's ambiguous, it's subjective, and so on. We enter a world of hurt feelings and imaginations about what people are thinking about us, and motivations, all these kind of things. And the content of the human mind is intrinsically indefinable. And yet these laws are based on trying to come up with some kind of finality about the contents of human mind and the motivation behind some kind of a crime. Now, in Canada, what you have to do is not take these assurances by the ADL that everything is going to be observed and people's rights are going to be respected. You've got to go to where the hate laws have been in practice for years and even decades. Now, in Canada, all of these assurances were given to the Canadian people 30 years ago, and yet the story of hate crimes and legislation in Canada is a litany of abuses and anti-Christian persecutions of every kind. For example, up in BC a few years ago, a popular newspaper columnist, Doug Collins, simply asked the question. He said, well, maybe there weren't exactly 6 million Jews murdered in the Holocaust. Maybe it was less. Maybe it was 5.5 million. You know that that's a hate crime in Canada, to doubt in any way the Holocaust. He was brought before the hate crimes tribunal. He was fined $3,000 for asking that question. He spent $200,000 in repeated court trials and appeals as they kept probing this question. Was Doug Collins really biased? Was he really biased? Well, now,
I think you made your point. Dimitri, do you have anything else you wanted to say?
I just wanted to ask, is this radio show being taped?
I don't think so. Okay.
I really appreciate to Doug. I really appreciate you clarifying that, and I thank you for information.
Thank you for looking into this.
Thanks very much for calling. Let's go to Matt, who's calling from Michigan. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Dr. Chan. I suspect the Patriot Act have created
Speak up a little higher, louder.
Sure. I think the Patriot Acts have created the basis by which anyone who's a dissenter or protester can then be prosecuted under hate crime, so-called laws, which are de facto color of law, at the whim of the government. And the B'nai B'rith, by the way, they supported the 1968 Nazi Gun Act that the United States government enacted. It's a word-for-word carbon copy of the Nazi Gun Act of 38. So B'nai B'rith was all behind that. And I suspect, as Joel Skousen pointed out, the states of emergency that have been declared, I think, play into this as well. So it looks like people who are dissenters are in for a rough time.
Well, I think that any time you pass a law, you take away a little freedom. Pass enough laws, there's no freedom left at all. And, of course, so many laws are passed with the idea of doing some good, and so often they do harm. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Matt. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening has been Ted Pike. And, of course, one of the perfect examples of a vague statement is abortion was originally legalized only for rape and incest.
Yes.
And, of course, for the health of the mother. But they never defined what the health of the mother is. And the health of the mother is the fact that the mother says, I don't want this child. It's going to make me nervous. I'm going to have a mental breakdown. I just don't want this child. It's bad for my health. And that then becomes the justification for killing the child. When they started off with the environmental laws, they were only ready to save the bald eagle. And, of course, now they can take away your property because you got a salamander on it. Whenever you pass a law, why, of course, you create a monster. And you create enough laws, there are no freedom left. So I think people have to be very, very wary. And, of course, there are always people who want to improve on things. Is our society getting better or is it getting worse? Well, I would suggest it is getting worse, and there's no legislation that can be passed that I can think of that won't make matters even worse still. Ted, what are your closing thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Well, as Matt was mentioning, the Patriot Act is a great invasion of our privacy, and there's been a tremendous amount of attention paid to that in the conservative media, conservative talk shows, and so on. But we have been very negligent in looking into the tremendous threat of so-called anti-hate laws. These anti-hate laws, the big federal anti-hate law, which will become law this spring, all of the votes are necessary there now in the Senate and the House, will lead, gradually extend to the loss of our freedom of speech. And that is a tremendous loss to lose our First Amendment rights as the Canadian people have also lost them. We have to get busy. We have to get educated. And as I said earlier, I have an excellent, excellent video you should show in your church, your conservative club, your Sunday school class. It's called Hate Laws, Making Criminals of Christians, a wonderful 80-minute educational experience for you. And that's available at our website at www.hatelawsexposed.org. That's hatelawsexposed.org. Or you could call me at area 503-631-3808 and give me your credit card number and I'll fire you off a copy. And we've got to get educated fast, folks, if we are going to prevent a hate crimes bureaucracy like Canada's from being established in the United States.
All right. Well, thank you so very much. Our guest has been Pastor Ted Pike. And Dimitri, this program will be rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon. If you want to rehear this program, it will be from 4 to 6 in the 8th. Because it's not on it is on a videotape that we've retaped this. Thanks so much, Ted.
Thank you, Doctor.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you're out there in the listening audience and listening to us, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we reach out across America. Now, remember our telephone number, it's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. You can certainly go ahead and pick up our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can listen to our radio programs some 5 hours every day on the Internet, 5 hours every day on satellite, 5 hours every day somewhere in America on radio, and 4 hours a day on shortwave. Please tell your friends about our programs, about the shortwave and the Internet, or the radio program you're listening to. Encourage them to listen. Now, we're involved in a battle of ideas, but behind that battle of ideas are powerful spiritual forces that are intent upon destroying this country. And, of course, remember, every time you pass a law, you take away a little freedom. And when you have enough laws, there's no freedom left. Liberty and limited government are synonymous, and tyranny and total government are synonymous. Which direction do you think we're moving? We mentioned in the last hour, I think everybody should get a copy of the Inside the Red Zone. That's the wonderful book by Igor that we talked to last week. And, of course, he was a officer in the Soviet military officer. And, of course, it tells you how to prepare for the possibility of a biological or chemical or nuclear attack on America. And as we move towards World War III, as we move towards a war with Iran and a war with North Korea, and probably with Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Islamic world, and if you think that we can continue killing Iraqi civilians without them retaliating here in America, I think you're sadly mistaken. The latest figures, and you can go up on Google on the Internet and type it in, Iraqi civilians, 100,000 Iraqi civilians. That is the estimate, 100,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed, and while we're liberating them. I mean, certainly many of them have even been killed by other Iraqis, but this never would have happened if we had not gone in. And, of course, we went in because there were weapons of mass destruction. Those weapons of mass destruction were there. They were moved into Syria. They were moved into Iran. And we had supplied those to Saddam Hussein. And nobody wants to talk about that. We kept Saddam Hussein in power. Nothing is as it appears to be. If you'd like to know how we kept Saddam Hussein in power, why, we'd be glad to send you an article out of the Washington Post showing how we financed Saddam and helped Saddam and aided Saddam and encouraged Saddam and provided him with the chemical and nuclear weapons. And it comes right out, of course, the Washington Post. We'll send that to you free of charge. And then, of course, the book See No Evil by Robert Baer. I think we still have a few copies. He was a CIA agent working within Iraq in 1995. And as he said, I never met an Iraqi who didn't believe that the United States was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. I never met an Iraqi who didn't believe the United States was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. And when you read his book, you realize we were keeping him in power. Why? Why, the finest enemy that money could buy, because behind everything that's going on today are spiritual forces and spiritual plans, and I think they're moving us towards World War III. And if you believe that God is just, don't you believe he's going to bring his judgment on America? And the rain will fall on the just and the unjust. And it behooves us to be prepared to draw close to our Lord, but also to be prepared what lies ahead. Remember the book, Inside the Red Zone, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, give us a call at the same number, 1-800-544-8927. It's the story of the secret societies that came to America in 1640. Not what I wrote, but what the Satanists wrote about them. You'll read their references, you can get their books and find out about them. They're sold right here in Santa Cruz. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.